The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
We're going to go to John 1 tonight, where we left off. It's said that the Apostle John actually said more with less words than any other writer. We certainly saw that, I think, in John 1, verse 1 through 5. In the prologue, we saw that Jesus Christ was the Logos. He was with God from the beginning, and He was God. And we saw that everything was made by Him, and He was the light of men. But yet men rejected that light because they preferred darkness. Now the rest of the chapter tells us an awful lot more about Jesus Christ. And it's surprising in a way because of how much it tells us in this one chapter. In chapter 1 alone, there's 21 different titles for Jesus Christ. I'm just going to run through these quickly just to give you an idea about how the Apostle John is coloring our image and our understanding of who this being really is. And he's giving us so much more than I think we recognize by a casual reading. In verse 1, we see he's the Word. Again, in verse 1, he's God. In verse 4, he's life. In verse 4, again, he's the light of men. And then in verse 9, he's called the true light. In verse 14, the only begotten of the Father. And then it says, by way of reminder, that he is made of flesh. In verse 14, he's called Jesus Christ. In verse 17, Christ in 20, Lord in 23, Jesus in 29, the Lamb of God in 29. He's called a man, and the Son of God in verse 34. He's called Rabbi and Master in verse 38. Called the Messiah and Jesus of Nazareth. He's called the Son of God in verse 49, the King of Israel in verse 49, and the Son of Man in verse 51. It's an amazing amount of information in just one chapter. And so he presents so very much in this first chapter, and he shows us the incarnation of Christ. And here we see this being stepping out of eternity and stepping into human history. And so let's go to chapter 1 and verse 6, where it says this: There was a man sent from God whose name was John. And so we're now introduced to John the Baptist as being sent from God. And so the word sent is apostolamenos, and the word apostle actually comes from this word, and it means, of course, sent, someone sent from God. But yet this word actually gives a stronger authority to this term of being sent, a stronger significance. It's like someone who sends an envoy out with a special commission. And so you begin to see that John the Baptist's part that he plays in the gospel message and the plan of God is of pretty great significance. It's interesting, too, to note this. The Apostle John was actually originally a follower of John the Baptist. And so it's natural, isn't it, for him to emphasize John the Baptist in the beginning of his gospel. But he does so with every reference. He makes sure that the reader understands that Jesus Christ is superior to John the Baptist. And I think he probably does this for a reason. It's this: John the Baptist was a prophet, and it had been centuries since Israel had had a prophet speak to them. They had had no voice of a prophet. And so John came prophesying that a Messiah was going to come. And he had a message and was sent from God. And the people, they turned to him. He found a fairly good acceptance by the common people. They were fascinated by him and attracted by him. And they gave him high marks, you might say. And so the Apostle John probably felt a need to put the Baptist ministry in perspective. And so in verse 7, through 9, he says this. The same came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. And then he says he was not that light, but he was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which lights every man that comes into the world. And so here we're seeing a difference between these two. John the Baptist came into being. Christ was someone who always existed. John was to bear witness of the light, and Christ was the true light. And so Christ's light was that light that illuminates our lives. That is, his way of living, his mannerism, his character, light our way, and they're the example for us to follow. And his light also shines on us, doesn't it? And then we become lights in this world, and we reflect his light to others. And so John came to bear witness to that light, and that is, he was to point to Jesus Christ as the one, direct people to him. I ask you for a moment to imagine the darkness of a world that had no sun. And then imagine that suddenly a sun appears. And then imagine this. People have to have the sun pointed out to them because they're in such darkness. They don't even understand what it is or see it. That's what was going on here. The light came into the world, and the world didn't even recognize it. They didn't see it as the light that it was. And so it is. Christ comes into the world, and the world is so morally and ethically corrupt that they have to point him out to mankind who he created. So again, John the Baptist came to point out Christ to others. But we're like John. We're not the true light, are we? But we're to be lights in the world, aren't we? And we're to shine the light that Christ shines onto us, and the light that we're able to reflect in our lives is to be a light to the rest of the world. And so we see in Malachi, of course, as we're familiar with, that the sun is a symbol of Jesus Christ, and that sun's light is reflected on by the moon. And the moon goes through these phases. And so there is a symbolism here in which Christ is like the sun and we are like the moon, reflecting this light to the world. And so we're to be like John in that sense, a lesser light pointing to Jesus Christ. And so it is that we are to be his witnesses. As he said to the apostles after the resurrection, you will be witnesses unto me both in Jerusalem and Judea, and in fact in all the world. We're his witnesses today. And so we reflect the light of God, reflect the light of Jesus Christ in our jobs and at school and in our homes and in our families. We're to go out into the world and we're to point the way to Christ by our actions, by the way that we live, setting a personal example that reflects him. And I want to make a comment about this, because sometimes we as Christians have gotten this wrong. That is, we're called and we come to Christ, and after a little bit we start reflecting light, don't we? And then we get sometimes to where we start thinking, hey, I'm doing pretty good. Hey, look at me. We start showing off our Bible knowledge. We know prophecy. We know these scriptures. We know the truth of God, and they don't. And we start focusing on ourselves as being a light, don't we? See, John the Baptist didn't do that, did he? There was none greater. He said that he wasn't worthy to untie Christ's shoe. And so Christ pointed out the beautiful humility of this individual who was John the Baptist. And so there's a lesson for us to be like John the Baptist and let our light shine as a lesser light. He never drew attention to himself, but rather was directing people to Christ. And we have that ministry. Now, one final thought regarding Christ being the true light. The word true is significant. It's alethinos in the Greek, and it means real or genuine, real light. So you understand, in Christ's time, there were other lights to follow, weren't there? Some of them followed Simon Magus. Some of them followed various Pharisaical leaders, didn't they? But they weren't the genuine light. There are other religions, and there are other religions today, aren't there, out there, all kinds of different religions. And they have little flickers, because in every religion there is some truth that have been brought in, even if it's made part of a lie. And so people see flickers, and they're attracted to that, sometimes like moths to a flame. But it's not the true light. Jesus Christ is the true light. The others are just partial lights. And I think we can see that from this perspective in the context of what we're reading here. So, John was like the night watchman in a sense. It's nighttime, and then the night watchman, finally the morning comes, the dawn arrives, and the night watchman goes around and announces the morning. And he announces it to everybody whose eyes are closed. Christ's light is like the coming of the dawn. You ever sometimes get up early enough to watch that, so it's dark outside and then things get kind of gray and the light begins to fill the sky, and then you see the shadows, don't you? But then when Christ, like that sunlight, comes, and as it gets brighter and brighter, eventually there are no shadows. Everything is clearly defined. And that's how his light should be in our life, isn't it? That he should, as we begin to be converted more deeply and more deeply, his light should shine through us more and more, and there should be fewer and fewer shadows, fewer and fewer gray areas in our life. And so anyway, these men saw Jesus Christ, and they had the shadows dissipated. The people throughout, for I guess 4,000 years before this, they guessed about what God was like. They didn't know what God was like. And now here he comes, and he walks and he talks with humankind, so everyone could see him, fully displayed, in terms everyone could understand. Here was a being uncompromising with the truth, one who deeply loved God's law. He wouldn't cave into pressures or to temptation, but neither was he an ascetic. He would drink wine, he would eat decent meals, and he would enjoy himself. Here is a picture of what God would really be like. He's not a monk in an ivory tower, is he? He's not like the Calvinist religion or the Amish, that just everything has to be black and you can't have any beauty. It's a wonderful God we serve, isn't it? But this is how we see him, because if you've seen Christ, you've seen the Father. The greatest man on earth, and yet the greatest man on earth would stoop to wash the feet of the least man on earth. He would take time for anyone and everyone if necessary. Not exclusive, loved women, loved Gentiles, all humans. Magnificent being. He is our light. He's the true light. And John the Baptist came to bear witness of that light, a light everyone can see. And the world, they had their eyes glued shut, wide shut. John 1:10, he was in the world, and the world was made by him, and yet the world knew him not. Now, when it says that he was in the world, I think there's two possible meanings to that. One is this: he has to be an integral part of the world, doesn't he? Because he created it. He was part of its planning, part of the execution of the creation. And he was invested in it in every way. He upholds this world by the word of his power. And so he's in it, inextricably tied to it. But then he came to the earth and manifested himself as a human being. And then he was in the world. And he was in the world just like you and I are right now. We are to be in the world, but not of the world. And that's the way he was. He walked this earth, untouched by so much that we're affected by. He was not of the world. And the world didn't know him. Imagine that. No flash of insight who this being was. They should have paid him homage, shouldn't they? The Creator. But they couldn't tell who he was. They ignored him in the beginning, and then in the end they rejected him. And in verse 11 it says this: He came unto his own, but his own received him not. See, he didn't just come to his own or come into the world, but it says he came into his own, meaning literally into his own home. Because these were his own people. This was his own family, and even his family rejected him and mocked him at some time, some of his brothers. And it's easy to kind of see this as ironic, because here were the Jews. They weren't a very great people, were they? They were a subject people in a very small land. And the northern part of Israel itself belonged to the Samaritans. And here it is, this small, insignificant, tiny country, and Christ, the Creator of the world and universe, calls them his own. They should have welcomed him in admiration. They had the oracles of God. They were told in advance when he would come, for example, in Daniel 9. They knew he was to come. They knew there would be four empires, and he would be the fourth. He would come under the rule of the fourth beast. And the scriptures told them where he would come from, where he'd be born, the tribe he would come from. And then here he comes with signs and miracles, bearing his life as a gift to mankind. It was obvious, if anyone was paying attention. Obvious. And they received him not. It's interesting to me that the word received here means to welcome to a place or to take under one's side. It's the same word that he uses in John 14, verse 3, where he says, I go and prepare a place for you, and I'll come again and I'll receive you unto myself, that where I am you may be also. So you see this kind of intimacy that is implied by this. This is the way Jesus Christ is going to receive you and me into the kingdom with open arms. He'll welcome us into the kingdom. He'll welcome us, bring us alongside him as one of his own people and one of his family. To me, there is a phenomenal lesson that can be learned in all of this. Here were the Jews, a called and chosen people of God. They had a divine place in God's plan. And God had prepared them a place. He brought them back out of Babylon. He set them up as a nation, and they were there prepared, and they had an opportunity to be first to accept Jesus Christ. They didn't take the opportunity. They rejected an awesome chance in life. And that's a tragedy when that happens to any of us, you know that? You know, too few people, I think, see this lesson in life. You know, you and I can be at the right place, and we can be at the right time, and we can do the wrong thing because we didn't prepare in advance. Everything's ready, opportunity comes, and we don't do what we can do to take advantage of the opportunity. You know, you've seen this. Parent prepares the child, right? Gets them through high school. They prepare them for college. They got a college fund. The kid can go. They've got the money. Everything's ready. But the kid says, well, I don't think I need college. And then what happens in life? A chance for promotion comes up, and they want someone with a degree. And they miss the opportunity. And yet everything was prepared if only they would have taken the opportunity. And so on the other side of this coin, you do see kids, don't you, that they decide early on, you know, I'm not going to go ahead and follow temptation. I'm going to not go ahead and do things that are wrong. And they think, you know, someday something good is going to come along, and I want to be ready for it, and I want to be prepared. And so there's a lot of people that will go without all the goodies and all the toys, and they'll bank their money. They'll invest their money. And then when that opportunity comes, the deal of a lifetime is here, and they're fluid. They have the money. And others are going, wow, if only I could, if only it was different, if I would have saved it. You understand? So the point is, there is a place for the preparation being set. And now look at us as a church of God. We have been called. We have been placed within the body. We've been prepared. We've been given a legacy. It was handed to us, the truth of God on a platter, haven't we? And people are letting it go, aren't they? They're letting it pass by. And right now there's a knock on the door of the church. There's a knock and an opportunity for repentance, a chance of a lifetime to turn it around and get on board with Jesus Christ. And we've been prepared and we're right here. We could go either way. And some are going to miss the opportunity now, aren't they? These people miss the opportunity then. We don't want to miss the opportunity now. John 1 and verse 12 says this. But as many as received him, to them he gave power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. So he wasn't received by everyone, but he was received by some. And so he makes an enormous promise to those who received him. So in the first chapter of John, Jesus reveals or is revealed for who he is. And he reveals what we can be. And this is really impressive. Receiving him gives us power to be no less than the sons of God. This word power is important. I think it's exousia in the Greek, and it means privilege, authority, competency, strength and power. So we were given the privilege of becoming sons with him. Man, that is a privilege, isn't it? Imagine this, to be able to be sons of God. Is there anything greater? Is there anything of more value? Is there anything you could think to attain to in life that could match this priceless gift? No. So we are privileged to be the sons and daughters of God. But he also says this, the root of the power, the word power, comes from existi, meaning legal right. That is, we have been given the authority of sons of God. In a figurative sense, it's like being able to go out in public. Now I want you to think about this for a minute, because Jesus said that we shouldn't be ashamed of him. You understand my point is that you and I are given the power to be sons and daughters of God. And so we need not be afraid to claim that in this world. We can go out in public with that title, that is, and not be ashamed of it at all, because he has given us the legal right. You don't have to shrink back in saying, yes, we are. We're the children of God. So we can bear this status in the world. The other point is this. It also means competency, strength, and power. So look, we are not inadequate. We're competent to do this. He's given it, us the competence, through his power. It's not our competency, it's his. And we have the strength. That is, we have the right. And he gives us his strength, so that we can and we will be the children of God. Okay, now here's the question. We have been given the power to be the sons and daughters of God. What kind of son or daughter are we? Have you seen families where sometimes the children are raised, they kind of take everything for granted? It's expected that they should have these fine tennis shoes. It's expected that they should have the latest clothing the kids wear. It's expected now in some circles that you should have a car given to you by your parents when you turn 16. It's just amazing. Some kids will just take and take and take and take from the family, and they never think, you know, I have an obligation here. And other kids do have that sense. And they, as they grow older, don't tend to take everything for granted, and don't take for example, kids will leave home and think, I don't really need that house anymore. I don't really need that anymore. So they'll just go, and they don't stay in touch with the family. Other children are so grateful and appreciative, and they've built a relationship with the parents, and they, though they may leave, will continue to stay in touch, continue to be grateful, continue to be appreciative, and continue to stay linked to the family. What kind of children are we? Do we just take God's benefits for granted? Do you just expect it because we're his children? Or do we really are we grateful for those things that we have? Or do we always want more? Give it some thought. The Jews thought that they were the children of God because of their physical birth. This was not the case. The scriptures state that we, on the other hand, can become the children of God, even though we are, but it still says that you can be. And so it indicates this process of spiritual birth. And it says, because we believe on his name. That doesn't mean, when it says believing on his name, it's not referring to the name having some magical power. It's not referring to the name being having to be said in a specific way, like Yahweh or Jehovah or something like that. It's not magical in that sense. But what the name represents, and that was the Jewish sense in those days. The Jewish sense was not that what the name was, so much as what the name represented in terms of a person's character. That's why they were often named after, you know, for example, the 12 tribes were named after events or personality types and things like that during their birth. And so it is that we believe on Jesus' name. We believe on who he is. We believe on what he is. We believe on the character that he has and his holiness. And that means this, that when we believe on something, then our actions are going to follow in accordance with our belief. And so we come to a point where we see him for what he is, and then juxtaposed to that is us. And we see ourselves for what we are. And that brings us to repentance. And it's part of this process in which we are then baptized and then cleansed by baptism. And by the Spirit of God then, the Spirit can be put in us. And at that point, we are begotten. New life is conceived within us. And that's what we read in the next verse here. In chapter 1 and verse 13, it says, speaking of us, them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And of course, this word born here is geneo in the Greek, and it can be either translated as born, or it can be translated as begotten. In this case, it should be begotten. And it simply means to procreate, and so on. But I remember talking to a guy who grew up in Greece, and he spoke Greek and read Greek, and I asked him to go over this with me, because at one time there was a big argument in the Worldwide Church of God over this issue. And he told me that when geneo is used, for example, there is another symbolo or something, I think is the Greek name for memory, of procreation. And the reason geneo is used, he said, is because it means that which is begotten and shall be born. In other words, there is a very positive side to this, and that's why this term was used. Anyway, we're not yet born of God, but we have that seed in us, as it says, and that seed then is causing growth to develop within us as the fruits of the Spirit begin to come out, and as we begin to mature and we grow in the womb of the church, just like the embryo grows in the womb of its mother. Right now we have the divine nature implanted in us because of our belief in Jesus Christ and who he is. But a birth is going to take place ultimately, a birth into the family and the kingdom of God. Okay, Jesus also then came to be an example for us. John 1 and verse 14 says this, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The glory is the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." So Jesus Christ went through the very same process we go through. He was flesh and blood, he was begotten of the Spirit, and he was ultimately born again. And so these men, if you can imagine such a thing, actually beheld him. And that's what they're trying to convey in the Gospels, and that's what John is trying to show us. He's trying to color a picture for us of what this incredible being was like. And so it says they beheld him, and this word is asthestai, says, and in every case it means to see with the eye. So there was no vision of God that was accurate. But with him, they were able to see what God would be like if he were a man. And he uses the word flesh. And this is interesting because it means meat. It means carnal. And I suggest that the use of this word means that he would have had with the flesh carnal human nature. Because it is the carnal flesh. And so the Logos was made flesh. Flesh and blood, muscle stretched over this being who was God. But he had, with what the nature of our flesh is, every pull that we have. And so it says that he was pulled or tested like we all are. He feels everything that we have felt. I know that some made an argument about this once, saying that he didn't have, he didn't have a temptation to take drugs or to stick a needle in his arm. But there is the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. He was pulled in all of those ways, in his ways. Because you aren't maybe pulled to stick a needle in your arm, but you're still pulled some way that is related to one of these three areas. He was pulled like all of us, and yet without sin, that he was God. And it did not look the same to him. He saw the depravity. He saw the filth. He saw the pollution. And it was repelling to him. And so he was without sin. To consider that God could be flesh and blood was unthinkable to many of the Greeks. And they just thought the body was no more than a physical prison and the soul and spirit were trapped inside this body. But this being was different. He was flesh and blood, and yet God, the fullness of the Godhead, dwelt in him. What do you think it was like to behold him? What do you think it was like to be with him for 3.5 years, eating with him, bathing with him, asking questions, making mistakes, getting corrected by him? What did you think they saw? Hebrews 2, "For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For truly he took not on him the nature of angels, but he took on him the seed of Abraham. Wherefore in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in all things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he's able to succor or help those who are tempted." I have a question about this. How come it says that we're in all our lifetime subject to bondage, death, because of death? Anybody have any comments on that? You know, I see people today, I mean, like midlife crisis, what's that all about? You understand the fact that we get older and we want to cram everything into our lives, or you see the bumper sticker that says whoever dies with the most toys wins. And Can you imagine how different life would be if we didn't die? Would we make planned obsolescence? No. No, we wouldn't, would we? We'd make everything of the highest quality. Everything would always be done right. Because there's no rush to make your millions before you die. There's no rush to get in the final party before it all comes to an end. You see how that's a bondage that I don't think we realize, but it's like running in the background of our minds all the time. We've got to get while the getting's good kind of thing. So anyway, he came and dwelt with man. And when it talks about him dwelling with man, it actually is a word that means to tent. Strong says this, it's to reside as God did in the tabernacle of old. The way this should read is this, the word became flesh and tabernacled among us. So God came down and camped with us. He tented with us. This is a few implications I want to bring out before we end tonight. Number one, a tent is a humble dwelling. God didn't come down and palace with us, did he? He was tempted in all ways like we are. He went through what we go through. He didn't. At one point, he didn't have a place to lay his head. Humble and meager in the role he played on earth. Second point is this. A tent is a temporary abode. It's for those people who don't really have a permanent home. Jesus said, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man had nowhere to lay his head. Shepherds use tents to travel with the sheep. They don't live out in a nice house far away from the sheep. And so Jesus was the chief shepherd, and so he made his bed with the sheep, and he would be with them. Another point is this. Soldiers use tents. Jesus Christ came to fight a titanic struggle with Satan the devil. The issue was the rulership of the earth. It's a war, and you and I are in a war. But because we don't see the bombs going off, we don't see the flashes of light and hear the explosions, we sometimes forget that we're in a war and a struggle. But a tent is something a soldier uses, and we should realize that we're in this temporary mode while we're here on earth. And so he pitched his tent on earth, and he waged war on the earth, and he won. Another point is this. Strangers and pilgrims use tents. And so Jesus was only here temporarily. He wasn't going to be here permanently because he was not of this world. And it's interesting how the patriarchs used tents as well, because they were pilgrims and they were called to be so, I believe, as an example for us to always remind us that we are, like Christ was, a stranger and pilgrim. And so it is that the ancient tabernacle was a type. And so God dwelt in that tabernacle with his people, and they carted that thing around everywhere they went. And that's where the mercy seat was. And the Shekinah glory of God emanated from there. And the Shekinah, of course, means that which dwells. But it was the visible presence of God. And it was, they say, actually seen when the high priest went in to the Holy of Holies. And remember when when the tabernacle was dedicated, there was the Shekinah meeting there, and a cloud covered the tent of the congregation at the time, and the Lord filled that tabernacle. So in a like manner, he is to fill us. And Paul speaks of this earthly house, this tabernacle being dissolved one day. That is, it speaks of our body being a tabernacle in which God lives in us, and we are the temple of God. And so John is saying this, I think. He saw the Shekinah glory of God in Jesus Christ, and that it came down and dwelt with men, and that he lived in close association with his disciples, and he conversed and ate and talked with them. And this is our lesson for the Feast of Tabernacles, isn't it? They erected little booths, and there the head of household would meet with family and with friends and share food and enjoy fellowship. Jesus Christ is the head of household, and he tabernacled with men, and he shares his food with us and fellowship with us. So here he is, John the Apostle, who Christ loved, sharing his experience with God, with you and me. And he said that he took on the same tent we have. And they saw this glory of God. It was right before them. And now I want to ask the question, what was it like? Because there wasn't just one of them. Remember, two or three are a witness. There was 12. It's a whole jury. An entire jury is telling us what this being is like, living with him for 3.5 years, doing all this with him. And then it says he was the only begotten. Of course, that doesn't mean there won't be others who are begotten. It just means a place of special, relationship. So church historian Philip Schaeff says this way, these men were with him, and here's what he believes they saw. His zeal never degenerated into passion, nor his constancy into obstinacy, nor his benevolence into weakness, nor his tenderness into sentimentality. His unworldliness was free from indifference and unsociability. His dignity was free from pride and presumption. His affability free from undue familiarity. His self-denial free from moroseness. His temperance free from austerity. He combined childlike innocence with manly strength, absorbing devotion to God with untiring interest in the welfare of man, tender love to the sinner, and uncompromising severity against sin. He had commanding dignity with humility, fearless courage with wise caution, unyielding firmness, and yet with gentleness. Can you see a being that would be perfectly balanced? Because we're like one extreme or the other sometimes. But this is what they saw. And they saw it constantly, never changing, because God changes not. Man, that would have been an experience, wouldn't it? I would love it. And I actually hope we'll get that chance in a place of safety, that we'll be taught by him like they were taught. And we'll see him as we grow and develop in our final stages and kind of get the icing of character put on the cake of character there. So they beheld his glory, full of grace and truth. And that grace doesn't just mean unmerited pardon. It means poise in the way he handled himself. Grace, graciously. And then truth. And this is the profound message of any other point that John brings out. This being was a being of truth, and truth trumped doctrinal issues. It was always the truth. He was the truth and the life of men.